Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's Great Conversation is with Claire G. Coleman. The Final Draft Great Conversations podcast is all about books, writing, and literary culture. I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. Final Draft is dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to household names. Every week we look into the issues that drive our storytelling and help you discover more from the books you love. These are the stories that make us who we are. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands. These are unceded lands, and treaty has never been made with Australia's First Nations. And I guess wherever you're listening, you are going to be on someone else's land. There is going to be a country, a group of people who were displaced 250-odd years ago. And a part of this conversation and a part of every conversation that we have on this podcast is about acknowledging that and thinking about the implications of that. And to that end, I want to introduce Claire G. Coleman. Claire is a Noongar writer of fiction, essays, poetry, and criticism. She has books out including Terra Nullius, The Old Lie, and Lies Damned Lies. She's got a new book coming up in July. And she joined me for this conversation ostensibly to talk about a fantastic initiative called In Case You Missed It 50, which was looking to support and bring back to the attention of the public books that were published during the pandemic. But Claire and I, if you've ever caught one of our conversations, you can go right back to the beginning of the podcast. Claire was one of our very first guests. We always end up talking far and wide. So we definitely get into Lies, Damned Lies, her most recent book from 2021, which looks at the lies that have been foundational to the history of this country that we call Australia, but of course has had many other names for many different people who have lived here for 60 plus thousand years. We also talk about speculative fiction writing. We talk about Claire's other books. We talk about the necessity to tell stories and to tell truth and to try to discover what that truth is. And most importantly, Claire is going to give us a little bit of a preview of her new book that is coming out in July. Can't say too much. That's Claire's job. So I would like to invite you to join me as we discover Claire G. Coleman's oeuvre, including Lies, Damned Lies, and a preview of a brand new book. Hello.
Hello.
You're on the road. Looks nice where you are.
Yeah. I've got that behind me. Peak Lake, Victoria.
Ah, terrific. Thanks for taking the time out of your road trip.
All right. Yeah, and I'd like to apologise in advance if too many trucks go past.
That's okay.
I'm going to call over that.
I think we call that Atmos, and we say that it adds texture to the conversation.
Excellent.
Let's see how we go. All right, here we go. 1, 2, 3. I'm Andrew Popel. I'm an extremely excited Andrew Popel because I have been able to organize sort of last minute and a really like a conversation that is going to be super exciting because I always love chatting with Claire G. Coleman. Claire is a Noongar writer of fiction, essays, poetry, criticism. She's the author of Terra Nullius, The Old Lie, Lies, Damned Lies, as well as numerous other pieces in publications far and wide. It's always great to chat, Claire. Welcome.
Thank you, Andrew. You always make me sound so clever.
You are like you are clever. Don't talk yourself down here. I was writing your intro and I was on your website and I was just like, oh, that's right. There's that article I've got to get to and this article. But look, realistically, we're here to kind of talk a little bit about publishing and the horror impact of the last few years on new releases, of which you've had two that have really been impacted, especially by COVID. You will forgive me, though, if I wheedle in a few bookish questions.
Of course.
Yeah. And I thought, look, I wanted to actually start talking about lies and look, I guess also by proxy truth, because your most recent book is Lies, Damned Lies. Before that, you have the incredible The Old Lie. And of course, your first novel was Terra Nullius, of course, named for perhaps the most infamous lie in so-called Australia's history. You'll forgive if I notice a bit of a theme going on here. So let's start with what does this idea of truth and lies mean to you variously as a novelist, which is all about fiction, and also as a chronicler of history?
Well, Lies would be the big topic of our current society if it was for the fact that everyone seems determined to ignore the existence of lies. Even American politics, Donald Trump invented the phrase, or someone around Donald Trump invented the phrase, alternative facts. Well, that's a lie. An alternative fact is a lie. And the concept of fake news is a lie. And even we've even got to the point in our society where we are, where people try and discredit the real news by calling the truth fake news. So we're actually at this situation now where, in a way, fake stuff has become, like fake news has become the dominant culture. And it's really hard to work out what's true anymore. Well, it's not hard to work out what's true if you look, but even online, lately there's been this concept of people saying that people who are like who believe lies are saying that fact checkers can't be trusted. That as soon as something says it's a fact check, then obviously if it says the word fact check, that must be a lie because they've been taught that fact checkers lie. So we've got this situation where truth has become essentially optional in our society, but that's not new. It's just becoming more overt. I mean, the first bit of fake news in Australian history is the country itself.
It feels like it can start to feel like we live in this extraordinarily contingent world where it's all about what you woke up and looked at first. Until it's sort of you start to dig a little bit, and then you realize the person who's screaming at you fake news, alternate facts, says you can't believe any of them, but believe me, well, yeah, you know, you've got to. Where do you go? And I want to dig a little bit more into lies, damned lies later on, but where do you go when it comes to starting trying to assert ideas like truth and fact? And when you are writing, history as Lies, Damned Lies deals with, where do you go and how do you start to assert truth and fact?
A good starting point is the kind of multi-hundred-year-old oral history in Australia, which is seeming a lot of time more accurate than what is written. Also, I look into the truth hidden between the lies, if you like. It's like when somebody is lying, the lie leaves a silhouette, and that silhouette can often be found the truth. But also, you go back to primary sources. I mean, the classic one is going back to the primary source of Captain Cook's journals. Rather than reading what people said about Cook, look at what he said about himself. And then you realise that in Australian history, it's not even been necessary to lie as such. In the story of Cook, it's not necessary to lie about Cook because people don't want to know the truth. People are more obsessed with the mythology. And they don't even want to think about the truth. So going back to primary sources is helpful. But also you need to understand that people also lie about their own history, about the primary in their primary sources. And the sometimes what you have to do is think what someone has to gain from lying. And one of the fact thing that historical fact checkers do, people who are checking history, they say that if there's two sources and they disagree, look who had the most to gain from lying. And that will tell you who the truth is. And the classic example is the massacre that happened on my ancestral country in the 1780s, where the white fella history says there was a white man was murdered and his family retaliated and killed some Aboriginal people. But the oral history for my extended family names the person who speared him and said that the white man had raped the girl and that's why they punished him for the rape. And you look at, well, what do white people have to gain? Well, there's a lot to gain from covering up massacres. They don't want to be held to account for the massacre. What do Aboriginal people have to gain? Well, nothing except the truth coming out. So if you look at it that way, generally the people who have the least to gain from lying will be the ones that are telling the truth. And that's kind of a good starting point, I think.
So Lies, Damn Lies does go to the source material, and it identifies and exposes myths, it exposes inconsistencies, it exposes, let's say the title again for the people in the cheap seats, The Lies, Damned Lies, around this mainstream story of the last 250 or so years of history. I think it's probably really important, though, that we actually establish like why we're talking about that, because there are people out there who are saying, I mean, most recently, you know, it feels a little bit dirty to kind of repeat this notion around, you know, it's not sorry, but I forgive you, that is the hardest thing to say. Like, well, but let's establish, why are we talking about this? What is the ongoing process of colonization, and how does the truth and the lies of this history impact our current world? Why do we need to be talking about this?
Well, part of the principle of colonization, it starts with if someone wants to be colonized, you've either got to start with the notion that there's no one living there, or the people living there are not worthy of that place, or do not have a sense of possession of the land. And the classic one about that is, of course, Terra Nullius, erasing Aboriginal possession of the land, is a lie upon which Australia was kind of established. And in the lies built into colonisation are there to protect the colony from any notion that it could have been illegitimate. The mythology of Australia is all about making Australia seem to be something it's not. Australia wants to think of itself as a peaceful, friendly colony where Aboriginal people and white people kind of lived in harmony. And to an extent we did, but when Aboriginal people and white people lived in harmony, it was mostly the work of the Aboriginal people to ensure that happened, because certainly the colonizer didn't show any intent within history. If you look at the historical record, there was no intent by the colonizer to colonize peacefully. The intent was to colonise and erase Aboriginal people, and that's written in the primary sources. So the colony doesn't want to think of itself as illegitimate or as a violent, as colonisation is a violent act. So the colony rewrites itself on a constant basis, and that's the kind of the reason for the purpose of the lies. Colonisers don't want to think about what's happened.
Is it fair then to, you talked about this process of rewriting, which is the really fascinating notion, because we're not just talking about a single lie. Like we can go to Lies, Damned Lies. We can look, you've already mentioned you went to the source, Cook's diaries, and there are inconsistencies there where we can see the shadows of the truth. But would it be fair to say that we constantly see this rewriting happening in public discourse and even in political discourse, maybe even as recently as, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago?
Well, yeah, of course. And it's been ongoing, certainly as long as I've been working as a writer and paying closer attention. Because once I started writing, I started paying closer attention to what is said and what is thought by people. Whether I'm writing fiction or non-fiction, understanding what people are saying and what they're thinking helps to come up with better stories, helps to write better stories, better essays, or better fiction. And certainly Morrison saying, I forgive you is harder to say than sorry. Mm. I don't even think that's true. I don't believe that for a moment. I don't believe that forgiving someone is harder than apologizing, because if it was, then Aboriginal people have obviously been the strongest people in Australia, because we're constantly being called upon to forgive the colony and forgive the colonizer, and without any actual attempt at saying sorry. And the classic lie, if you want to think of it this way, Scott Morrison could be seen as like teaching us a constant masterclass in lying and getting away with it. The classic one is the circumnavigation of Australia reenactment, where he intended to reenact the circumnavigation of Australia by Cook. When Cook never circumnavigated Australia. If you're trying to reenact something that never happened, that's kind of an enactment, because you can't reenact something that didn't exist. It's kind of, it's this notion of, let's just come up with a lie that suits our idea of what we want the colony to be, and then pretend that's the truth. And maybe if we say it enough times, people will believe it. Mm. And unfortunately, they do. History is constantly being rewritten. And when it is rewritten, they by the colonizers to put lies into the history, and we try and correct those lies. We're accused of trying to rewrite history.
And it gets this incredible foothold. I mean, it's nice to have this conversation, and it's nice to be able to say, ha ha ha, how ignorant was he? He wants to enact something that was never done in the first place to reenact. But it gains a foothold in popular consciousness. There are we see various forms of cognitive dissonance that people try to employ, things like it all happened in the past, it has nothing to do with me. But I mean, in your day-to-day, like, what do you see? How do these lies maintain this foothold in people's consciousness, and why don't they want to challenge them?
There's a classic lie that has come up recently in my social media, and it's not the first time, but this particular falsehood has been appearing in Australian historiographical discourse for, I don't know, 50 years or something. Mm-hmm. There's a series of paintings, rock art paintings in the Northern Kimberley called the Gyeonggyeon, or they're called the Bradshaw figures by anthropologists, because I discovered by an anthropologist called Bradshaw. And there's a running myth in the Australian discourse that they were painted by African people, not by Aboriginal people.
Okay.
And the only explanation for why this would be something that they constantly state is so they can claim that there's been another migration into Australia. And there's a constant claims of multiple waves of migration, including one of the first anthropologists to really try and do a deep dive and understand Aboriginal culture, a guy called Tyndale, who said that there were three migrations into Australia. Now, this comes up again and again. It came up in 2015 or something, or it could be 2012. With an article by Keith Windschuttle, in which he claimed that this three migrations into Australia theory, three migrations of Aboriginal people theory, was the truth, and that it was erased by Aboriginal people in an attempt to claim land rights. When there's no actual evidence anywhere of more than one. There's been no evidence anywhere in the genetics, in the history, archaeological record, or in any sort of history at all, there's been more than one migration of Aboriginal people. The reason that lie persists is because if the colonizers can claim that the current Aboriginal people are merely the third or something wave of people migrating to Australia, it is less of a crime if they are to try and steal the land from us. Even though that doesn't even make sense, we're still there before they were. But that one justifies the colony. The other one that's constantly dragged up to justify the colony is the myth that Cook discovered Australia. Mm. By no definition of the word discover could Cook have discovered Australia. And it's not even in his the primary sources that state that Cook discovered Australia. It's stated he explored the East Coast and mapped it. The first person to map the East Coast of Australia. But his own diaries state that everything west of where he was New Holland, because the Dutch had been there first.
It's got a real, all of this has got a real flavour of kind of academic, I know you are, so what am I? Like, you know, if you did it first, we did it better, so everyone gets to, you know, be a good person by virtue of, you know, someone else doing it. So we've got these lies and they're being perpetuated. I wanted to actually take another step on, because if we talk exclusively in, you know, sort of facts this and lies that, we do run the risk of also dehumanizing the very real impact that these lies have, where we're sort of talking about groups of people or historical people. If you are comfortable discussing it, can you talk a little bit about what is in Lies, Damned Lies, the impact that the lies have had on your life and on your family?
Well, certainly there's a, on a very personal level, there was a lie, and that lie was my grandfather lied about his ancestry and lied about my father's ancestry, even to my father. And that lie, of course, was passed on to me. It was for the most noble of reasons. It was done to protect us because back at the time, all in WA, when my dad was born, all children and actually from when my dad was born, from 1905, my dad was born 1931, so from 1905, not 1931, 1941, so 1905 to 1971. All Aboriginal children who were born with a mixed race, who weren't so-called pure Aboriginal, as the government, as the courts called it, were automatically considered wards of the state and were therefore subject to be taken away. And there's a number of reasons, the number of things, lies they said to justify this, but essentially my dad would have been automatically a ward of the state at birth if he had a file with the Department of Aborigines. So his father lied and said that he was Fijian, which protected my brother protected my dad from being taken. Also, would have protected my brother from being taken because he was born in 1970, and the law changed in 1971. I was born in 74, so I would have missed out on the actual worst of the Solar Generation laws. But it wasn't until essentially my 20s, relatively late in my 20s, that I discovered my Aboriginal ancestry. Now, people say it was recently, but it's basically more than 20 years ago. That's not recent. That's a kind of – but it took a while to return to culture and country. It's been a work of decades and will be the work of a lifetime, because generally it takes a lifetime to really – to repair some damage like that. So this colonization and the lies that were told, and then my grandfather, a lie my grandfather told to protect us from the government, have all impacted on my family, having a kind of a hole in our culture where we weren't brought up in culture. But then again, we're Noongar, and then the Noongar are among the worst damaged of First Nations people, in that we suffered among the worst massacres. I'm not saying we copped it worse than the Gadigal or Gregal people of where Sydney is now. The people of the Eora Nation, they copped it probably worse than we did because they copped it for longer. But the Noongar people had the worst legislative removal of our rights of any people in Australia, and therefore we suffered quite badly. And, of course, we were colonised after the other parts of Australia to an extent, not after Melbourne, but after South Australia and well after New South Wales. And I think the government learnt something about cruelty by the time they colonised us, because they did a very bad, very nasty thing to us. And really, my family has been wounded. We have intergenerational trauma. We have lost our country and our language is almost extinct. These things are all a direct response to the laws that on the system that considered my people to be unworthy of any rights of the land we had lived on forever.
Which is sort of the foundational lie on which everything else has been built.
Absolutely. And that's another thing. The foundational lie is that, of course, we didn't exist or we live our land. They call that the lie. They call that terra nullius. But in itself, the way we look at terra nullius in Australia is a lie as well, because until land rights began, there was no concept of terra nullius either. There was no declaration at any point that we weren't here. It was just assumed that we weren't here. So this idea that terra nullius was declared by Cook, that too is a lie. The more you look into it, the more you realise that the first mention of terra nullius by the courts were during the birth of land rights, which is, if you think about it, they didn't care about the fact that our land, that we didn't own our land and that we wanted it back until we asked for it.
Like, it's really, I mean, it is really tempting here to look at this as some sort of almost absurdly comic bureaucratic stuff up, where it wasn't until someone looked for the paperwork that they realized it hadn't been filed properly in the late 18th century. And, you know, Duncan from accounting is in real trouble because he didn't, you know, fill it out in triplicate. But this has this ongoing impact, it feels like ridiculously inadequate to continue a conversation about this. But I mean, I want to continue the conversation because I feel like the way these conversations are being had, the fact that I'm talking to probably one of my favorite authors about books that she is writing that are continuing this conversation must show us something. And I'm really interested, like, I love your books, but I've followed you on social media for a while, and I noticed that your quest to combat lies and misinformation is basically a daily practice. I mean, we all have to take a mental health break from Twitter occasionally, but basically a daily practice, often it seems at a personal cost to you. And I wonder, like, as great as books are, do you sometimes feel like that is where a lot of your work is happening? Like, do you feel like maybe the battleground for ideas isn't always in the publications, but in these strange digital spaces?
Well, I think it's an extension of something that Jello Biafra from the Dead Kennedys, in his first ever spoken word album, and it stuck with me. I can't remember which track it was, but his first ever spoken word album was basically a series of socio-political rants, essentially. And one of them, he said in it, don't hate the media, become the media. And then he explained, he said, I don't mean by that start zines or start your own radio station. What I mean is there's a lie in the media, tell everyone you know about it on a personal level. Mm. And if somebody says something that's a lie, then tell them that that's not true, and then tell everyone around them that it's not true. And then eventually then, because lies spread by word of mouth, and so can the truth. And lies are viral, but truth can be viral. And I often talk to everyone about this notion of viral truth. And I suppose one of the reasons to combat misinformation online is because the misinformation online does go viral and goes viral very quickly. So therefore, truth online can go viral. Mm. And people have asked me, for example, if it's okay to tweet one of my opinion pieces that brings out a truth. And I say, well, in reality, the reason I do a lot of my work is so that it's there for people to disseminate it and use it to tell the truth and speak truth to power and counter lies of truth. And I don't think that we can say with certainty that giving someone the truth will automatically erase the lies. I think that any notion of that is foolish. I don't think that it works. I don't think reality works that way. Mm. And that's why social media can be so difficult, because someone will tell a lie and you counter that lie, and then they reply with another lie and you counter that lie. And sometimes it just gets out of hand. And I don't believe that on social media, ignoring the lies makes them go away. Some people say, oh, don't reply to them, then the lies will go away. I don't think that works that way, because those lies are going viral whether we counter them or not. So therefore, ignoring them isn't working, because ignoring them is just they're just continuing. So I think maybe to an extent, countering them is working. And I hope that over time, people who are armed to counter lies will continue to do so. And by armed to counter lies, I mean people who are good at replying, who are good at digging up the truth quickly, and other people do it, but also who are emotionally capable. Because I don't think it's not sometimes being on social media, particularly Twitter, can be a bit like doing a swan dive into a toilet.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Enough said. let's come back then to your books.
Sure.
There's a book show. I like talking books. I do think, as much as you know, Twitter kind of embodies that whole idea of the lie getting halfway around the world while the truth is putting its pants on, kind of cliche. Books have this authority. Books are spaces to expand ideas. And you've had these two incredible books. Lies Damned Lies was out last year. The Old Lie came out in 2019. And they have been sort of impacted, as everything has been impacted, by the last 2 years. Now, like, for all the time I spend reading, I still find a lot about the industry opaque. So you've had your books out. The books are in the stores. They're on the shelves. They're on the interwebs. But how has the pandemic really affected your ability to work and to earn around making these releases?
It's one of those ironies of the world that the of all art forms, the art form that is most solitary, which is writing books, is also the art form that is most reliant on public appearances.
Mm.
It's one of those lines. And I think it's because, you know, even like people who are, for example, TV stars on movies, they've got movie trailers, they've got TV adverts, and they're appearing and being pulled into people's screens, and they're always there. But to a large extent, the success of a book is reliant on word of mouth. And sometimes the first word of mouth that people receive about a book is from the author. So I can guarantee that there has been loss to the book sales of anyone whose book came out during the COVID pandemic. Even the point where the kind of insider word had been that book sales have remained steady through the last 2 years of the pandemic, but book sales of new books have dropped.
Mm.
So people are buying books that they've heard of, or books they already know, authors they already know. And of course, so I've had two books out during the pandemic. The first one was September 2019, which is The Old Lie, which isn't technically during COVID, but only got half a touring season. You know, you normally tour a book for about a year, and only got half a year before, or less than half a year, about 4 months before it all came crashing down. And Lies Damn Lies has lost so far all of its touring season, in that things were just starting to clear up in August, and then in September everything started closing up again, and I still have not been anywhere to promote that book. Mm. And that's just a simple fact. Sure, there's online as well, but I haven't seen the numbers, but I suspect that sales from people attending a virtual writers' festival are probably lower, because at a writers' festival, it's this kind of not that obvious thing, but if an author gets up on stage and talks and the audience members enjoy their conference, what they have to say, they generally go straight out to the festival bookstore by the book.
Mm.
So if you go to a festival and you can talk and you can really talk, you might go out to a festival and there might be 150 people in the audience. Maybe only 20 of them have never heard of your book. Well, a large number of them might have heard of the book, because often you're in a panel with a bunch of people who also have books out, but their fans turn up too. So there'll be a large percentage who've never heard of your book. And of those, a percentage will go out and buy your book. I don't know what the percentage is. It varies. But every time I've done a writer's festival panel, I've sold a chunk of books, maybe 20, maybe 50. But those, in fact, I once sold 50 books at a writer's festival in Darwin, where the population of Darwin's like 5 people. No, it's not quite, a bit more than that. But the population of Darwin is tiny, and I sold 50 books, which is all the town, which was all that was in the town on the weekend of the writer's festival. The entire supply of Terra Nullius was wiped out in a day when I was at the writer's festival. So I know that there's a certain amount of sales that come from literally from being there, and that none of us can be there, and that's really been quite a difficult experience.
I mean, I can vouch for this anecdotally. I know, like, I don't buy a lot of books because I don't have to. Part of getting to talk to amazing people is like, well, you might be able to ask better questions if you actually read them, and most of the books that I have bought in recent memory have been people that I've either seen speak or heard speak through some other capacity, through a podcast, through their YouTube. An analogy that comes to mind is like musos doing concerts. And I mean, I feel like anyone who's interested even a little bit in music knows that the industry is getting the guts ripped out by streaming services, and they're making their money as part of the ancillary to doing appearances. Like, is that a fair comparison? Am I talking out of my hat here?
No, that's a pretty good comparison. In book, I think that the translation from audience member to buyer in a book at writers' festivals is a bit stronger than it is in, for example, music festivals. I don't think people who listen, who go see a band necessarily go and buy the music as much as people who see a writer speak go and buy their books.
Because the people at writers' festivals all have tote bags and they're not dripping in sweat. They've got somewhere to put the book. That's what it's got to be.
and let's face it, people really like getting books signed. And I, except for people for signing for people I know, and my I had a book launch in Alice Springs while I was broken down there. Except for that, I haven't signed books for 2 years, which for me is like that's a very long time to go without signing a book, really.
I feel like actually the last time we met face to face, you might have been wearing a wrist guard. Was that from signing books? Because I notice it's off now. That's all resolved from no more book signing.
No, the wrist guard was when I actually fell over and broke my wrist, which is hilarious because I was on book tour with a broken wrist for like a month.
So a lot of people out there with a very fake looking left handed Claire G. Coleman signature.
That's true, and that's how I learned how to hold the pen between two fingers.
Very good. And then
with broken wrist, which is hilarious. Yeah, I remember signing books with broken wrist, which is the funniest thing ever. But yeah, it's really interesting because I can't be sure that my books have suffered from a lack of buzz, but I do know that Terra Nullius is still my best selling book. And that was the only book that has not had any pandemic effect. I just hope it's over by July because I have another book out in July.
All right, hang on. Before we get to that's definitely on the agenda. We are chatting. A part of why we are chatting is because Lies Damned Lies is part of the In Case You Missed It or ICYMI 50, including other authors like Jamie Marina Lau's Gunk Baby, the other half of you from Michael Muhammad Ahmed. It's bringing these books back to the fore, 50 books that were released, dropping them out in the world. How did you get involved in this and are you noticing anything from it?
I haven't. It's actually really hard to keep track of book sales because it's often hard. Even the publisher can't get much notice book sales. But I have noticed there's been a bit more. Whenever I've done a bit of media from it, and I have noticed every time I do media from it, there seems to be a spike of interest, and interest does translate to books, not one-to-one, but it is useful. And it's actually interesting because I'm more concerned. People sometimes think of Lies and Lies as almost like a debut book because it's not because it's my first non-fiction book. In fact, one of the media reviews actually called my debut, which is hilarious considering. But I think it is actually this, In Case You Missed It, 50. I think there is sales. And you can actually see some interest on when they have a special stand for them at some bookstores. Mm. You do see some interest. And I know that it's one of those little quirks of the industry that often a new book isn't given all that long to prove itself. If it doesn't prove itself, it's often remaindered and it's not reordered. Apologies, my phone just rang. Often books can miss out and are remaindered and certainly and at least they're not reordered, and that can be really problematic. I might not have ever been in danger of that. But I certainly would have been in danger of Lies Down Lies being more obscure than my other two books, maybe. I don't know. And I do think the buzz has returned a bit because it came out in September. It would have been approaching the doldrums by now if it didn't have any sales. So it's nice to see it coming back. But one thing, I've always been worried, though, even more than worried about myself, and everyone has the right to worry about themselves. I'm always worried about debut authors who have books out during the pandemic. A very dangerous situation to be in because if your first book is remained, the chance of getting a second book out is not very high. As far as how I got involved in the In Case You Missed It, I got an email. I didn't even know it was going to be happening. And I think that's everyone who who is involved in this was asked, or maybe they asked our publishers, I don't know. Although I do understand a bit about how the publishing industry works after 5 years in the limelight industry, I still don't know how publicists work. Mm. It's a dark art, publicity.
It really is. They magic their way into my emails, and I end up having these incredible conversations. It's a good art. But I mean, I'm just even looking at this list, and people have only got a few more days. It's going till the end of February, and in case you missed it, 50. That doesn't mean these books disappear, but you get them a little bit cheap. It's like 20% off, and
20% off is a good discount.
Mm. And there's incredible books. Like, you scroll down, and Black and Blue from Veronica Gori, which won the Victorian Premier's Literary Award, like the big prize, that's there. The Mother Wound from Imani Haider, which also took out a prize at Victorian Premier's Literary Award. Like, these are not the books that they're just like, oh, well, we better kind of get rid of them. They're like, these are just incredible books, including Lies, Damned Lies. We've talked a lot about things like COVID and the last 2 years. I want to try and end us on a little bit of a high note. You've already mentioned July. Can I do a little bit of a preamble, like a red carpet up to you telling me about this new book?
Sure.
Okay. I know, like, in your writing, it's no longer a spoiler, I think, to say that Terra Nullius isn't exactly a contemporary novel. Like, it's, yeah. And I know you're a Pratchett fan. And I know your worlds, while they're very different to the disc world, I feel like they have this same power to create these, like, relatable, understandable parallels with the world that we live in that let readers kind of explore and learn through the narrative. So I guess my question is either, maybe you can choose which one of these questions you actually answer, is either would you turn your hand to fantasy as opposed to the more sort of science fiction space, or just where this creative interpretive energy comes from?
I might try and answer both those questions. They're good questions.
I kind of asked them hoping you would.
For me, the kind of creative interpretive energy comes from just if I've got something to say, and as the way to say it often appears to me in a, like a flash into my mind. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure I even, when I'm writing a novel, sit down to try and write another novel. I just sit down and with an idea that I already have, and it's there. It's normally complete. And I think it comes from a lot of reading, a lot of interest in books and movies and stuff like that. And I think if anything, the way I look at the world is what drives these creative ideas. Mm. I see the world slightly askew to how everyone else sees it, and I think it's because I'm more interested in what's behind the curtain or in what's between the lines of a story. So if I'm reading a story, the first thing I try and do is dismantle it and see what's not being told in the story, and I can't help myself. It's just the way my brain is wired or something. Mm-hmm. I think it's just to me, Pratchett. I think it's similar to the way that that Terry Pratchett. He appears to just look at the world that's around him and see something slightly off kilter and amusing about it. And he builds a story around that. And it's kind of the same thing, but for me, I mean, I write a lot darker. But I think the off kilter narrative is always there if you know how to look for it. Mm. And in my case, I'm not even looking for it, it comes to me. As far as writing fantasy is concerned, I have neither a unique interest in writing fantasy nor an interest in not writing fantasy. And I'm sure at some point in my life a story will occur, because the worlds I build are because that's what the story demands. Mm. Right? If the Terra Nullius demanded a certain world, The Old Lie demanded a certain world, my next novel demands a certain world, and I am certain that one day a story will be there to be written, and it will demand a fantasy world, in which case I will write one. And I don't think it's, although to an extent, the Australian publishing and literary literature industry looks down on fantasy. It looks down on science fiction as well, to an extent. So, and I suppose it has been said that with Terra Nullius, I elevated Australian science fiction and changed the industry a bit so that it's no longer completely out of the ordinary taboo to imagine writing sci-fi in this country. So I'm sure if I set my mind to writing a fantasy novel, that's the only way I can tell a story. It'll shift everyone's attitude towards fantasy as well. I just haven't had a fantasy story in me to write yet.
We're going to file that into the future, maybe something to look forward to, maybe not. But before people start like throwing their coffee at the radio, at all of these teasers, you've said July, there's something new coming up. Mm-hmm. What, if anything, are you able to tell us about it?
I can tell you it's a near future speculative fiction novel.
Okay.
It's called Enclave. It's out July the 15th. It's gone to proofs already, so I'm going to be with Hachette, like my other two novels. And I suppose it's about looking at a society where the mainstream have lost their shared humanity with the people who are different to them, I suppose, and the harm that does to people.
I thought you said this was near future. That sounds like now.
That's happened. Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you like, because the best speculative fiction is done by extrapolating. Yeah. I've taken the world we are in now and extrapolated certain aspects of it, particularly the individualism and this weird individualism we have now, where people are very individualistic, but want every other individual to be just like them. It's like we're all individuals. We all don't care about each other, but we're all the same. I've taken that kind of attitude and I've extrapolated and see where my mind takes it. And that I've ended up with a novel called Enclave.
That sounds so exciting. July, Hachette, I'm like already penciling August to try and call you back in my diary. Claire G. Coleman is chatting to me. Her most recent book is Lies, Damned Lies. It is by no means her debut because she has the incredible Terra Nullius and The Old Lie that you can go out, you can buy. Lies, Damned Lies, you're going to get for about 20% off as part of In Case You Missed It 50 till the end of February. Put July, Enclave in your calendar. Claire, holy heck, that's a lot. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
That's it for this great conversation with Claire G. Coleman. Claire has her latest book is Lies, Damned Lies. She has a new book called Enclave coming out in July. You can expect to hear more from Claire. And I would like to say thank you for joining me today. Thank you for always joining me for these conversations. Today, the sound was a little bit interesting. But look, I would never let a little bit of sound quality get in the way of an amazing conversation. Great Conversations is recorded on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. You can stay in touch, find the show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Just look for @finaldraft2ser. Hey, if you want to actually catch up with me, I'm on Twitter too. You can variously find me by searching for Andrew Popel, or my handle on some of those is @writesblock. Subscribe in your podcast. There will be a new Final Draft several times a week at the moment. We have book club, we have conversations, we have features, and I love bringing them to you. I am Andrew Popel. I will be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft. As always, I hope you got a good book and happy reading to you.